Welcome to Tonic Boom, a specialist capital markets podcast series brought to you by Tonic, the expertise-led consultancy dedicated to giving firms more. Join our host, our resident Tonic Ninjas, and industry experts as we drop the mic on the hot market topics across high-profile domains such as margin, post-trade, treasury, risk, digital, legal, sustainability, and more. More expertise, more trust, more achieved. Ready for your dose of Tonic?
A very warm welcome back, everyone, to Tonic Boom's episode of From Investment to Impact, Driving Efficiency in Securities Financing. In part one, we explored when and why balance sheet cost optimization took center stage, and we spoke about some of the current challenges firms face. We're now going to dive into how the market is adapting and innovating to solve some of the cost pressures we discussed in part one head on. I'm Emma Watson, Tonic Sec Financing Lead, and I'd like to welcome back my friends and colleagues, Steve Letherby from Clearstream and Andy Turvey from GLMX, who, as we now know, both bring hands-on experience and deep insight into how securities financing underpins a cost-efficient business model. So for those of you who tuned in for part one, you will know that in true Tonic Boom style, we kicked off with an initial round of one truth and two lies, with the theme being our first jobs. In part one, I asked Andy what his first job was, with a twist. I asked Andy to try and throw us off by giving two lies and just one truth. Steve, we failed miserably. We asked Andy to speak Japanese and he didn't, and he threw us off. So well done, Andy. It's your turn now, Steve. So no pressure, but can you better Andy's first round of one truth and two lies?
I'm not sure if I can, but I will try. I'm going to start. So in my first job during university, so in the holidays, I worked on the go-karts at Butlin's Holiday Camp in Minehead. Now, for those of you who don't know what Butlin's is, say it's a holiday camp where people go and enjoy themselves for a week.
Enjoy?
Enjoy, yes, enjoy. No. It's not a prison camp. And while I was there, I bumped into the band Bucks Fizz in the staff canteen, who were actually performing in Butlin's that evening.
You may well have to explain who Bucks Fizz are, Steve. I know, as a seasoned market pro.
Bucks Fizz won the Eurovision Song Contest back in 1979. So that was job number one. Job number two was, you may or may not know, I'm a West Country boy. And so my first job was working on a cider farm, where I was responsible for picking up, distributing, delivering back the apples. And one day I found a dead rat while I was picking up the apples, and I thought it would be quite funny to put one of them into the vats of cider because I thought it would give it more flavour. I don't think there are any casualties from that, but who knows. Number three, my first job was a caddy at my local golf club, and I once sunk a 20-foot putt for the guy I was caddying the bag for, and this happened to be none other than Sean Connery.
Do you want to go first, Andy, or shall I?
You go first. You go first, Emma. Ladies first.
Well, one and two are confusing because I know you're from Somerset. So you've got Butlin's Minehead in there. You've got Scrumpy in there. Both big themes from Somerset. So potentially could both be true. I know you love your goal. I'm not sure you're that good. So I would love to think that you got to see Bucks Fizz perform. I love Bucks Fizz. So I'm going to go number one.
Yeah, I'm going to discount number one because 1979 you said they won, which would have made you 3 years old.
Yeah, but I wasn't saying that's when I was there when they won it. When I say Bucks Fizz, it might just have been one of the Bucks Fizz, but they call themselves Buck Fizz. So I think it was Mike Nolan was the guy.
He does seem to know a lot.
He does know a great deal. I think it's number one. I agree. I think number one, he faced up to the challenge beautifully.
Well, you're quite right on that. And you're quite right on the fact that number three is no way I'm going to sink a 20-foot putt.
Feel bad now, Steve.
So it was a Butlin's, yeah. So Bucks Fizz in the canteen. I didn't actually see him perform, but I saw a few others as well, but I wasn't sure if anybody would know who they are. So.
Oh, thanks, Steve. So, okay, let's crack on. As we've already said, cost pressures in securities financing aren't new, but the way firms are adapting, that's where it starts to get a bit more interesting. So from established market infrastructure to newer tech distributors, everyone is playing a part in reshaping how we think about efficiency. So let's kick off. So start with yourself, Steve. From your perspective, you're at the heart of market infrastructure. How would you say ICSDs and CSDs are evolving to support cost optimization, particularly in areas like settlement efficiency, collateral mobility, and interoperability?
Cool, yeah. So interesting question and set of questions there. So on the settlement efficiency side, I think that, you know, Clearstream itself has made massive strides with regards to settlement automation and making things a lot more STP, obviously to reduce manual errors and manual intervention. This then onward leads to lower fail rates, and then moves on to the reducing penalties under CSDR, which, as you know, can be recently introduced as well, which our clients are finding quite prohibitive as well. Also, consolidation of trades has been very important as well. So, again, helping to reduce settlement volumes and costs. Number three is probably harmonisation with T2S. I mean, ICSDs have aligned with T2S to allow centralised DVP settlement in central bank money. And this then reduces fragmentation, lowers cross-border settlement fees and increases liquidity pooling issues.
And that's super important.
Absolutely, yeah. So, you know, that's been a major push for Glitchium in the last few years. On the collateral optimization side, we've seen a massive shift with regards to being custody agnostic. So what we're looking at is moving across silo, across custodian, across tripartite agent, across ICSD. And we're looking at potential AI-powered solutions, which will allow you to look at assets, collateral, where it sits, and have the ability to mobilize and optimize that collateral allocation. And we at Glitchium are working very closely with Google on building the solution. In fact, part of it's already there. I can't say much more about that at the moment. With regard to multi-objective optimization, supporting different types of strategies, including things like cheapest to deliver, LCR, and haircuts as well. Again, custody agnostic piece is extremely important here. So looking through to non-sort of Glitchium custody inventory. And finally, on the collateral transformation, it's converting an eligible collateral into ineligible forms of collateral for central clearing, for example, so meaning less costs of sourcing new collateral as well. On the technology data side, we see data being extremely important now. So you've got things like benchmarking between client data and anonymized peer data. We've got things like, we've introduced something called Trade Proposer, which basically taken traditional marriage broking into the AI world, meaning a better reutilization of vital securities. And using AI functionality in data products, meaning generating bespoke data sets, visuals, and data analytics as well. And then finally, on the DLT and tokenization side, we are already focusing hugely on DLT and carrying out digital securities issuance, bringing down settlement costs and collateral friction. And then, of course, on the tokenized collateral management, you've got the likes of HQLX who are out there who have a product where they're looking to tokenize the collateral management within the frame of tripartite.
Absolutely. Thank you, Steve. So you mentioned AI there quite a lot. It's a common theme, I think, at the moment. So I guess probably all of us will probably agree seeing AI being used more and more in this space. So Andy, moving on to fintechs. Fintechs are bringing fresh tech into a space that's long been dominated by legacy processes. Where are you seeing the biggest wins when it comes to automating cost-heavy pain points or unlocking new efficiencies?
Thanks, Emma. I think it's a big topic, so I'm just going to skirt around it. I think scalability, efficiency, and the ability to reallocate human capital to more kind of cerebral value-added tasks with, you know, with that trade, you know, front and back, negotiation, execution. It's interesting now we go meet some of our clients who are, you know, just joined from university and they log straight into the platform. They think that's the way it's always been done. And when you try and explain to them that we used to have teams of people, teams of smart people sitting there processing tickets manually, hundreds and hundreds of trades a day, and the error rate was, you know, 5-8% because that's all you were doing. They look at you as if, you know, as if you were quite demented. Or how, you know, why did you do that? How long did you do that for? And you said, 20 years. They went, wow. So I think the uptick in efficiency across the trade cycle has really been a game changer. I think the ability to collate and disseminate your own market data, both what you trade and what you don't trade internally, so up to the PMs with the organization, has really kind of centralized a lot of that trading data where previously would have been lost. Equally, the ability to send, locate, and runs all available to digitize all of that. So, you know, you've got one kind of golden source of truth where all your records are centered has made a big difference. I think platforms generally, as well as facilitating scale in the liquid space, are also unable to support the whole lifecycle functionality, which is necessary for open trades, particularly in the credit and emerging market space. So the ability to manage, you know, large amounts of open business with complete accuracy, I think has been a game changer across the repo markets. Now, I remember well back in the day, looking at a central bank move, you know, with enormous trepidation, is it meant that you had to manually re-rate every open trade, which would essentially have to lock out 2 days where you couldn't do literally anything else. Steve nodding.
I think you had the easy job, actually, because you used to do that in the front office and I'd be in the middle office having to process it for you.
And then calling up and shouting, why are these all wrong? We've now moved on to the stage where it's literally 3 clicks on a platform to agree and process hundreds of open trades with complete accuracy, instantaneously, and with consistency across the board. It's really offering scaling and transparency, and I think an efficiency that wasn't there before.
Thank you. So I think maybe now let's zoom out a little and talk about strategic levers like maybe netting, clearing and product structure to help manage costs. So back to yourself, Steve, where do you see products such as Triparty, Autoborrow or netting services evolving to next?
I mean, I'm probably going to go over some of the stuff that I've talked about already, but obviously, you know, Triparty from an operational perspective has made collateral management far more efficient from a company's perspective. And then, you know, going back to things like AI that I've mentioned, predictive analytics, allocate collateral management in real time across repo, margin, sec lending. So I think intraday Triparty obviously is something that's coming through, whether it's via some other players in the market or whether it's something like HQLX, for example. And then standardization across region, things like haircuts and margining.
Oh, intraday Triparty. I like that. So are you seeing much demand for that?
No, not at the moment.
I mean, personally, I've been hearing lots about the sort of in the bilateral space, lots more chat about intraday repo recently, both sort of electronically and in the sort of digital space. But
in the space of maybe liquidity and intraday liquidity, I think that's where it will play an important part.
And do you think with T+1 and things like that in the future that we're going to see an uptick in volumes maybe around intraday?
Yeah, potentially. And then you look at what they're looking at in the US as well with managed equilibrium, for example, then I think that will only increase.
But again, that is going to require a quite significant investment in technology in order to make that happen, to make that as robust and resilient as overnight trading. And I think, you know, the market needs to move. The problem is that no one really wants to go first. If it were possible for the market to work together and say, this is where we need to get to by this date, then you've got liquidity, but it's all about liquidity. There's no good being the first guy that can do it if there's
no liquidity on the other side.
Yes, it's the collaboration piece again, isn't it?
It's a collaborative approach. We keep coming back to it.
Exactly. Key word, I think, for today. And I think that's actually what's so interesting about T+1 is it's going to be mandated. So it's going to be super interesting to see how the market and all the players respond to that.
I mean, if we look at things like Autoborrow, for example, as well, you've got obviously smarter router engines now. So Autoborrow evolve into probably a intelligent inventory routers, which I think is extremely important as well. Less fragmentation, again, single pool of liquidity, regardless of the custody or settlement location. So going back to what I was talking before about being custody agnostic as well. And buy-side access control on the Autoborrow side will be probably quite more prevalent as well, due to the fact that the beneficial owners will have maybe more real-time visibility as well on their assets on that side from an Autoborrow perspective. And then finally, going back to the things like ESG filters, for example, on those particular Autoborrows, so that's going to be probably a lot more integrated into those type of facilities as well.
Interesting. Is the Autoborrow, is that intraday or is that still overnight?
It's intraday.
It is intraday. Okay, thank you very much. So one more question for yourself, Andy. Do you sense firms are now asking more about front-to-back solutions, not just tools, but smarter workflow redesign?
Absolutely. I think both the buy and the sell side institutions, having adopted, you know, this innovative technologies, they've gone out and got the resources to do it. They have it. They're now keen to leverage it and digitize as much of the process as possible. So I think one of the reasons why platforms per se have been able to grow so quickly is that if you're a buy side and you're doing 50% of your business digitally and the other half you're doing in the kind of analog legacy style, then you're very aware of the friction around the legacy style. So you want to do as much of that business. You want to capitalize on the resources you've got and do as much of that business digitally as you can. Equally, if you are a big sell side institution and you spend a lot of internal capital on getting SDP and full integration to platforms, then anything you're doing outside of that protocol is by definition more clunky, more frictional and less efficient. So there's a kind of virtuous cycle of adoption there, which I think is really helping the platforms to grow. I think equally, once you have that adoption, you've got a business case around it, it might make it slightly easier to go and save more resources to deepen that integration. If you've got a book of business which is done digitally that works perfectly, and we've got great data around it, you've got great reporting around it, you've got analytics around it, then going and asking for, you know, further integration for lifecycle, whatever, is a much easier ask because it's a proven concept. I think repo and lending desks have historically not been the first in the queue for development budgets. Nobody likes us, we don't care. But while, you know, while the business case was always there, the workflow to support these new regulatory reports will always take precedence. Institutions look and say, what's coming down the pipe? Right, we need to get compliant with this and this and this, we need to report this. So the repo desks, except finance business, are not always front and centre of those discussions.
Yeah, those funding conversations can be really challenging.
But I think the thing that underpins all this is that it's a very, very interconnected business. So whatever's important to the buyer side is important to the sell side. The binding constraints on both sides of the trade have to be kind of borne in mind. So that means that the market as an entity has to work together in order to keep innovating. We've got to have this kind of open and transparent dialogue between the buyer side and the sell side and the vendors and the clearers. And that's how we stay strong. That's how we are able to kind of withstand whatever headwinds come down the pipe, whether it's, you know, economic or geopolitical. I mean, we know there's going to be more of this coming. I think after Liberation Day, the market responded extremely well. I mean, capital markets responded extremely well. The repo market responded well. And I don't think we've given ourselves enough credit for how robust and resilient that market was.
Well, I mean, if you look at it, I mean, the repo market kept the market going, didn't it, end of the day? So, you know, we had TC Pooling, which is a cleared repo product, which, you know, which basically volumes increased tenfold post-financial crisis.
We had the tools to withstand the shock.
Yeah, you've got the scale. Yeah.
And I think that's where we learn from these iterations. We say, what do we need to get through the next step and the next step? And the more we talk about it as an industry, the more adoption there's going to be of these things, of these tools, the more resources get put aside to put those in place, which makes the whole industry safer, more efficient, more transparent, which will allow it to continue to grow.
Love it. So the whole partnership, collaboration, mentioned those words lots today. I think standardization across the board as much as possible, adoption of best practices across the board, all of that just helps bind everything together and make everything work so much better and more efficiently for everybody. So we've covered a lot, from the tech that's driving efficiency to the strategic levers like clearing and collateral transformation. But looking ahead, maybe just a quick fire final question for you both. So Steve, Andy, if the goal is sustainable cost optimization, what's the next big opportunity? Where should the industry be doubling down?
Well, I think you said the goal is sustainable cost optimization. That's revenue. And I think everyone in this marketplace exists to add shareholder value. So I think the more we can push these efficiencies forward, the more we can manage the costs, the more we can make this kind of operationally intensive market more efficient, more transparent, then, you know, I think we're only kind of stage one of the journey. There's a lot further to go. And I think as long as the industry keeps working together, we can push that agenda and, you know, we'll get to where we need to be.
I mean, if you look at the reason why we are where we are now is sort of posted as an eight and around fact that rates are lower, the spreads are thinner. So which is why banks, organizations are looking at cost collateral optimization. I see both being the same. So the fact that we're looking at the cross custody, cross data source silos as well, across trading desk, treasury, custody, that type of thing, I think that's going to be so important going forward. End-to-end data integration, real-time inventory management as well. And it's just, you know, the banks are looking at the bottom line. The bottom line is how much are we going to save by doing this? And the conversations I've had with clients has been, you know, in the multiple millions.
And this is proven technology. The efficiencies and the cost savings, the revenue optimization is proven.
And I think one of the key messages here is really that the real shift happens when operational precision becomes a lever for strategic advantage. So that's where the investment turns into impact. Well, I think that's us just about done for today. Steve and Andy, you've taken this hot topic and expertly run with it. Brilliant stuff. We've covered a lot of ground, from the pressures firms are feeling today to the changes coming down the line. Some really helpful perspectives too on how going forward firms can sharpen their focus on cost efficiency. I feel like we've probably only just scratched the surface today. There's such a lot more that we could unpack. And I've got a feeling there's probably a few more securities financing episodes on the horizon. But a huge thank you to you both, Steve and Andy, for sharing your valuable insights. If you enjoyed today's discussion, don't forget to follow this podcast, share it with your colleague, or send in any questions or topics you'd like Tonic to cover next time. Thank you so much for listening. That's a wrap. See you next time for more Tonic Boom.
You've been listening to Tonic Boom. Don't forget to like and subscribe to stay up to date on the latest developments and industry opinion across capital markets. Visit thetonicconsultancy.com to see more of our expertise-led insights and end-to-end solutions. Tonic. More expertise, more trust, more achieved.